I personally am left very disappointed in my experience at virtually all North American Orthodox synagogues. And I think we tolerate far too much. I think that there's a disgraceful proliferation of things like Kiddush clubs in our synagogues, a tolerance of not just a lack of decorum, but a tolerance of just rampant disrespect for the Kedusha of the synagogue. There was actually an article in the organ of the OU written by Rav Moshe Weinberger speaking about just the non-implementation, a very simple thing to do, of simple spiritual talking in the synagogue. As you said, it's easy to give a sermon or a drasha which is intellectualized, where we give an interesting vort, where we are clever, and where we can explain something that may not really hit us very deeply in our kishkas. Rav Moshe Weinberger spoke about the fact that so many of our synagogues, there isn't much talk at all about God. And when it's suggested, the person that raises the suggestion is often diminished. So my question is really about the leadership, the broader leadership of the Jewish community, and here the Orthodox community, in terms of issuing directive, policy, inspiration. We know that in the Haredi world, for example, there have been steps to circumscribe the amount of money spent at simchas. These are the kind of steps that we don't see taken in the modern Orthodox world, as far as I'm aware. And I think that some really courageous leadership in terms of changing the culture of our synagogues that isn't coming necessarily ultimately from the local leadership, but coming from up above, that may have the ability of spreading down below, I think would go a long way in alleviating, as you mentioned, this really, really serious credibility problem that we have in terms of being a spiritual community where our houses of worship are really far from that.
What you're saying is very, very true, and there has been a lack of assertive leadership in this regard in all communities. Haredi community has a certain advantage, and that is when their leadership says something, their people follow. That's the discrimination between the Haredi leadership and the modern Orthodox leadership. But you're right, nevertheless, it doesn't exempt the modern Orthodox leadership from the responsibility of asserting its leadership in these areas. I wanted to say first something general about your point and then a couple of specifics. Number one, generally, as we look at the three areas that I outlined, and I think it pretty much covers the waterfront, what it really leaves out intentionally, by the way, my talk this evening, is Jewish education and its faults, faults in the curriculum, faults in teacher education, etc. But I try, whenever I speak to parents, to only criticize parents. When I speak to teachers, to only criticize teachers. It gets me a lot of trouble, but I don't think it's constructive for us, for some educators here, but mostly I gather not, for me to sit here and criticize Jewish education. But look at the family, spirituality, etc. The answer to a lot of these problems has to do with the role of the synagogue. For many reasons I'm not going to get into tonight, the role of the synagogue in Jewish life has diminished. It's been taken over, sometimes co-opted by school, yeshivas, etc. But the synagogue has a very important role, especially in educating adults. There's a problem with Jewish life, and that is that too often we were all educated Jewishly, some to the 6th grade, some to the 8th grade, some to high school, some to Kollel. But one has to constantly learn Torah consistent with one's age. Can't satisfy the thirst, spiritual thirst, the Torah thirst of a 40-year-old with a 10-year-old's learning. You can't learn the Parsha when you're 50 with the same stories about Noach that you learned when you were 8. It has to be updated and deepened and made more mature, and that's part of the role of the synagogue. And part part of making spirituality relevant and making tefillah relevant means understanding tefillah, understanding Beis HaKnesses, understanding it in a mature way, which takes a constant process of education. Education, as you know, doesn't just mean classroom education. It means educating people as to what prayer is all about. And, you know, look around your synagogues, even Jewishly educated synagogues, and talk to people about what prayer means, what tefillah means, and talk to adults, and they'll give you very childlike answers, you know, which is often why prayer is so disappointing for some of us, because we're praying like eight-year-olds. You know, you press the button hard enough, and you're going to get the M&Ms, or the gumdrops, or whatever. You know, that's what we were taught in grade school about that tefillah is. And tefillah is something much richer and much different and much more complex and nuanced than that. So, like so many problems, it's a process of education. And when one experiences what tefillah is, and there are many theories about what tefillah is. I mean, Moshe Weinberger would give a very different answer than perhaps I would give or someone else would give. But they're all answers within the Elu Ve'elu range. But one has to reflect deeply, and rabbis have to speak about tefillah. Meir Schiller, who spoke here earlier, and I were once on a panel at an OU conference, and Rabbi Lamb was in the audience. And Schiller works for Rabbi Lamb, right? He teaches in one of the YU high schools. So he said, you know, I can teach Gemara, they're learning Sharsha Nogach, for a whole year, and, you know, my kids will never hear anything about God. Very possible. Very possible to learn Gemara an entire year, to learn 30, 40, 50 plot of Gemara. And Gemara is the lion's share of the curriculum in most schools that I know of, left to right these days. And where's God? Right? God's not mentioned in Sharshanot and Sampora, very tangentially. Rabbi Lamb said very wisely from the audience, well, we don't talk about God in Yeshiva University. He's not in the curriculum, you know. But he's not in the curriculum anywhere else either. It's not a knock on Yeshiva University. Who talks about God? It's changed a little bit. You know, it's changed a little bit. Sometimes Tzoros changes it and forces you to confront God one way or the other. Even if you get angry at God, at least you're talking about God. But God talk is very, very important. What the thrust of my agenda for the Orthodox Union, and I made this clear to the people who hired me, is to reach out to synagogues. The reason I travel so much is to touch base with a wide variety of people. So you cannot remain a New York-centered. It could be centered in New York, but it has to reach synagogues. But synagogues, I mean, many people have pointed out that the Orthodox Union, the full name is Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America. We're not a union of congregations, and we have to be, and we have to start with congregations. Before we even have a union, you have to have a congregation. And you'll see more and more of an emphasis on synagogues, on articles in Jewish Action like Rabbi Weinberger's. At our upcoming convention, which is the last week of the year, the post-December 25th weekend, one track in the convention is synagogue improvement. You know, not the making better lights or whatever, but synagogue improvement in areas of Kavanah HaTfila and all of that means. I have found in my own shul where we also have this problem, always have this problem. By the way, these problems never become solved. If the Tosfos Yom Tov couldn't solve it, you know how hard he tried. He blamed the Gzeros Tach V'Tat, the horrible, horrible pogroms of the 17th century. He blamed it on the failure of proper decorum in the synagogues of Prague. But we have to try, and we have to expect we'll make some progress, some regress. But there has to be, and as far as I can, I'm responsible, there will be a national leadership outcry about this. There already is. But outcries are not enough. There has to be education. What tefillah is, how to properly pray. The rabbi has to model prayer, model true tefillah, and often the rabbi is the last person who can model tefillah because it's very difficult to sit up there and everybody watch you and demands on you to do this and that and the other thing. And we have to learn from wherever we can learn. The saddest story, it's a scary story that I know about decorum and shul. We had in Baltimore a shliach from Bnei Akiva who came from Israel to spend a year or two in Baltimore. And he came, and he left after several months. Why? Because he couldn't find a shul in Baltimore where the decorum was adequate. And there are many shuls in Baltimore whose decorum is very good, but he felt he didn't find anything near the shuls he was used to in Eretz Yisrael. In general, Eretz Yisrael, the decorum tends to be much better, especially in communities which haven't been Angloed, right? And especially Sephardic shuls are much more, show much more Kavanat Tzibur than Ashkenazic shuls. That's generally true. We have a lot to learn from our Sephardic brothers on that score. And one can learn from what their secrets are. Why is it true that you walk into the Spanish Portuguese synagogue in the west side, a few blocks from where I'm living now, and the decorum is such that you can, I mean, when you walk in, you can hear, people can hear your footsteps. And in the shtiebel down the block, all you can hear is footsteps. We have to ask ourselves these kinds of questions. There are reasons for it, historical reasons, tactical reasons, etc. But this shliach went back to Israel after just a few months. And before he left, he told me this story. He said when he was in Israel, he was a tour guide sometimes. Make a few bucks in the days when tourism was better than it is now. He was a tour guide. As a tour guide, he had to occasionally lead tours of mosques. All right? So he said, you can approach a mosque on Friday, and you'll think there's no one inside. That's how quiet it is. Then when you come inside, you see there are hundreds of men in prayer. Hundreds. But you don't hear a sound from the outside. The decorum is absolutely perfect. And this man tells me, you know, whenever I wonder why are the Arabs doing so well and we're not doing as well as we could be doing, you know, maybe they know how to address God a little bit better than we do. And after all, their name is Yishmael. So they know the secret of Yishmael. They know the secret of when God listens to. And we have to learn even from our enemies, and we have to learn what prayer is from the kavod hatfilah that they have. Now, obviously, there are things that they do that we don't want to learn from. But that's a model of prayer. A model of prayer. That's what prayer should be and can be. We don't take it seriously at all. Kiddush clubs, you have to be careful for. I was once invited to a scholar in residence in a shul, and I spoke out against Kiddush clubs. I figured that's motherhood and apple pie. Speak out against alcohol abuse and lack of decorum at once. Afterwards, I was criticized, you know, the rabbi goes to the Kiddush club. So, here I was, this, quote, national leader making a statement, and the local leader was getting in the way. But we can joke about these things, but they're very, very serious, and we really have to work hard on it.
Okay, now we're going to open up the questions, please. Just, there are two microphones and line up. May I suggest, I think, maybe we can take a few questions at once. If you want to ask questions once, then perhaps, like Robert Weinrib, can put it together, although we'll play that by ear.
I want to address a group, Baal Shuva group, people who become Orthodox. Judaism is definitely reaching this group. And why is Judaism relevant for this group? I go to a very small shul, and I was sitting beside somebody today, and our family's moving more and more towards, whatever you want to call it, and so are the people in our shul, and I see very strong marriages, very happy families, and I attribute it to Judaism, to Orthodox Judaism. And I was sitting next to somebody this afternoon. She said, oh, in our shul, you can't find any spirituality. And I kind of looked at her, and I said, well, in our shul, it's bringing everybody, it's very spiritual. Shabbos is wonderful. And I was at something a year ago, and Rabbi Skolvik was a moderator. And he was talking about Buddhism being full of Jews, and I was really shocked because I was pretty naive. And he was saying, you know, all the, you know, we have a retreat once a week with Shabbos. We have all the ethical issues that are dealt with in the Torah. And the things that people are searching for, the answers are in Judaism. And the more I delve into it, and, you know, at our shul, we deal with ethical issues and God and all kinds of things. I leave every shul every week.
What's your question?
Inspired.
What's the question?
So, on a positive note, like maybe the Baal Shuva group, maybe they're obviously getting, like somebody in my shul said, Shabbos is the best kept secret. Like the general Jewish population doesn't even know what it even means. So maybe somehow we could tap into this group because they're finding spirituality. so which is a positive thing.
Part of the problem with tonight's symposium is that, of course, we're focusing on the negative and on the faults, and there is much positive to be said about Judaism, about our practice, about our shuls, about our people, etc. And we can't lose track of that. And I think that my experience, the people that we tend to call Balei Tshuva these days, see the positives and don't want to see, and they shouldn't necessarily have to see the faults. We're here tonight to probe the faults, to try to improve them, not to be critical, not to be guilty of Lashon Hara or negativism or Chas V'Shalom despair, but by bringing out some of the problems. But at the same time, we're aware of the positives very, very much, and Balei Tshuva do see the positives. I want to say, though, that in my experience with, I don't like the term Balei Tshuva because technically it means something a little different than what we call them that nowadays, but people who are new to Orthodox observance generally tend, during their first phase of exposure to Orthodox Jewish practice, to see the positive, to see the Shabbos, to see, the struggle with ethical issues and everything that you mentioned. But then when they stay with it long enough, they begin to see some of the negatives and they become very disillusioned. Because, they're looking for something and they saw something which they thought was perfect. And as long as they can just look at the positive, and there's a lot of positive to look at, so it's great. And then when they start seeing the negatives, there's this great disillusionment that can sometimes be very dangerous. And that's one of the problems that we have to face as well. So there is a lot of positive, but there's a lot of negative, and we have to work together towards fixing it. There's also the newness and the freshness that Balei Tshuva brings to Judaism, which is very helpful, and which those of us who are born into observance need to appreciate and can appreciate. That freshness is very, very important. Most people like myself who routinely have seekers of one degree or another at our Shabbos table learn very quickly that we're not doing them a favor. They're doing us a favor because they're allowing us to look at what we take for granted from fresher eyes, from a fresher perspective. Anybody addressed your issues?
I have good news. The last two speakers have really addressed the question I was going to ask. But I'm at the microphone already. So I want to do two things. First of all, I want to listen to my son. I want to give you a shekoach for this extraordinary experience. I think it's been historic. And I think it will be a model to many other synagogues.
I get my energy because of the family I grew up in, and really all these ideas. No, I mean that in all seriousness. Those who know my father, my late mother, know that it's not out of, in a vacuum that I come to this. So I want to thank you in public.
Jay, you made me blush, which I haven't done in a long time. But anyways, having made the statement, the fact you're organizing, why I'm not going to ask the question, because both Rabbi Weinreb and the last speaker really addressed me what I was going to ask. And relate to you, Rabbi Weinreb, that isn't Jewish life a paradox? On the one hand, there are more people eating glatt kosher, less people keeping kosher. There are more people buying shmir mus at $18 a pound, going up every year, and not keeping a seder. On the other hand, there are thousands of young men and women studying Talmud, which never, we have the image that in Europe everybody was a rabbi, everybody knew shas by heart, and nothing could talk. So really, you've mentioned it, and I think the Balei Tshuva movement, perhaps, and the question you're going to ask, which I don't have to, because at the beginning you gave a very negative outlook. But you redeemed yourself, and you are agreeing that there's much room for optimism. And I'm pretty optimist and do hope that the fact there is a Balei Tshuva movement, the fact that young people are starting, should give us some. We have to do what we create shmiras and everything else, but I think we can have some optimism for the 21st century.
There's a line, and I always forget which way it goes. If things are so good, why are they so bad?
Right.
Or if things are so bad, why are they so good? It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And Medrash has a beautiful phrase, that's one of my favorite phrases in Chazal, Or v'choshech mishtamshim barvuvya. Light and darkness serving all mixed together. There's light and there's darkness wherever we look. I am not by nature a person who looks in the dark. I like to look at the light. But I always remember the story from Chelm. You know the story from Chelm? About the person who lost his watch. All right? It was a dark night, and he lost his watch. So there's one street lamp, and he looks for his watch under the street lamp. And someone comes over to him and says, you know, what are you doing? He says, I'm looking for my watch. Where'd you lose it? I lost it over there in the dark. So why are you looking for it here? Here it's light. Here I can see. There is dark and I can't see. If we look at all of our problems in the light, we're not going to find the problems. So we have to occasionally, as it not like tonight, to kind of allow ourselves to look at the dark. But the truth is that obviously much, much, much that is wonderful about the Jewish family and about Jewish spirituality and about learning Torah, et cetera, et cetera. But we also have to ask ourselves the question, if things are so good, you know how many Sfarim are printed in Eretz Yisrael every year? More than one a day. New Sfarim. Many more than one a day. I mean, something like 600 or 700 a year. How many Talmidim there are studying Gemara? It's more than ever in history. I mean, for sure. For sure. Statistically, more than ever in history. How many schools there are? How many Balei Tshuvas there are? I mean, my shul, it's just a former shul, the shul of 400 or 500 families, two-thirds of them, their parents were not observant. They came through NCSY, they came through Eishat Torah, they came through Osei Meach, they came through themselves. These are phenomena. You never used to have that. In pre-World War II Europe, they used to write books about the Baal Tshuva, the one single Baal Tshuva in the whole Poland. You know, what a rarity. And now it's much more common. These are all wonderful things. But yet, we struggle with problems, and we have to be frank and candid and open about our problems. Yeah.
I work in the area of bringing people to the pre-Baal Tshuva level. People who are out there that are either secular or reform, and I teach them enough to get them excited about the idea that Orthodox Judaism may offer them something that they hadn't thought was there before. Is there material to help me in the teaching level that I'm working at?
Yeah. There is material. I hate to toot the horn of my organization. But the OU has material, first of all, available on our website. There's lots of material on our website, www.ou.org. Very easy to remember. Material at all levels, but there are materials specifically at that level, especially a series of booklets known as Pardes, P-A-R-D-E-S, which is a series of booklets on topics ranging from love to ethical behavior to the Jewish view on vegetarianism, I don't know, a whole wide range of topics with leading questions for discussion and with source material, you know, appropriately translated. That's just one tool I think would be very helpful, especially for the entry point that you're discussing. I'll tell you something else. Although I, as obvious my talk, I have intellectual propensities, but I think ultimately what excites people about Jewish observance is not the intellectual dimension, but the experiential dimension. A good Jewish family life, a good Shabbos table that's really functioning well, a good kugel will always do much more than a good philosophical discussion. I'm not saying one shouldn't have the philosophical discussion, the text-based approach, but what Judaism is really is it's an experience. It's an experiential religion. We can talk here. We're prone to talk. Jews are great talkers, but ultimately it's the Jewish experience. That I heard a beautiful joke from the late Dr. Yosef Burg. I don't know if his name means anything to people here. He was a great leader, Mizrahi leader, passed away a few years ago, not long ago. So he used to tell a story about these three Jews who all became converts to Christianity in Russia. You know, you're talking about 100 years ago, more, whatever. They met on a train, on a railroad train. These three Jews, they all converted for one reason or another, as we shall soon see. So they're all Mishumadim. And they're talking, and they meet after many years. They haven't seen each other since childhood. And one says to the other, you know, why did you become a meshumet? This is going to be in Yiddish, the punchline, but then I'll translate it. But the Yiddish is priceless. Why did you become a meshumet? He says, me? You know, when I was a child, I wanted to become a doctor. To get into medical school in Tsarist Russia, if you're a Jew, you're finished. So I converted to Christianity. I got into medical school. Now I have this practice. I'm a flourishing physician. I'm wealthy and everything's fine. That's why I became a meshumet. Turn to the second one. Why did you become a meshumet? So he said, I became a meshumet. Remember that blonde girl that used to live down the block, you know, the shiksela? We fell in love. Her father owned all the forests in the whole province, lumber and everything. I married her. I took over the business. He died. I owned the business. You know, so I married this Gentile girl, and that's why I became a meshumet. All right? They turn to the third one. They say, why did you become a meshumet? So he says, Ich zulieb ibrutzeigung. All right? Out of conviction. All right? So they both say to him, Ibrutzeigung, das erzähl a goy. Tell that to a goy, conviction. No Jew converts out of conviction. For the blonde, for the medical school, for the money, okay, we understand that. But for Ibrutzeigung, forget about it. And I think it works the other way too. No one returns to Judaism to leave Ibrutzeigung. You can't argue a person into Orthodox Judaism. You can show him the positives, the experience. Experience of a Shabbos, of a Simchas Torah, of all the beauty of our religion, and a Jewish family that's functioning properly, and that's what the attraction is.
Rabbi, speaking of Christianity, could you give your view on the very, very strong support, especially in the United States, of the Christian Coalition, other groups like the International Christian Embassy of Jerusalem, Bridges for Peace, Christians for Israel? They seem to be taking a very, very outspoken and strong stand, lobbying the American government in particular to help Israel. And as you pointed out before, seem to be fully aware that the land is ours.
I'll share with you my ambivalence. Because there's a part of me that's very suspicious of the motives of Christians who support Jews and support Land of Israel, especially when they do so out of a religious Überzeugung and a religious conviction about the Second Coming, etc. So part of me is very suspicious. The same part of me which is suspicious of the other beliefs of those groups, which are against my political bent, which are extremely conservative to a point which I think sometimes threaten individual liberties. And I'm also troubled sometimes by the hatred which those groups can show toward others who disagree with them, on the one hand. On the other hand, there's no question that at this point in time, these are almost the only allies we have in the world. There's no question that one of the fastest growing religions, faster, I understand, growing faster even than Islam, is Pentecostalism, a Christian Protestant movement, where several cabinet members of the United States cabinet are members of Pentecostalists, Attorney General John Ashcroft being one. And they are people who are really Ohavei Yisrael. I mean, they love Jews. They hire Jews. When Ashcroft was a senator, I think, from Missouri, he had about half a dozen yarmulkes on his staff. And he appreciates Judaism in many ways. There's no question that President Bush's gut appreciation of Israel Tshuva to Christianity, he's a born-again. And there's no question that's very, very strong. The best line, so I'm torn. I'm just sharing with you, I'm torn. Right now I think we have to get our help from wherever it comes from, but I think we have to be, there's a phrase in Hebrew, kavdehu v'chashdehu, honor him, but suspect him. In other words, honor them, work with them, but be suspect. But the best line I heard was from Dennis Prager. Dennis Prager has a tape that's making the rounds these days. It's not a commercially produced tape. I have it in my car, wherever my car is now. Not in Toronto, somewhere between Baltimore and New York. And he said he gives a talk about just this topic, where he comes down strongly for working with these Christian groups, fundamentalist Christian groups. And he said, talks about the discussion he had with Jerry Falwell. All right, he's one of the leaders of this group. And he says, I said to him, Jerry, or Reverend Falwell, whatever he calls him, Reb Jerry, he says, tell you what, I'll make you a deal. You keep supporting Israel 100%. And when Jesus comes back on earth, all right, then we'll worry about what we'll do. But until Jesus comes back, you know, you be on our side. And then, you know, a Jew always takes this attitude. You know, the story, I hate to tell these stories, but they're gorgeous stories. All these Yiddish stories are really great. About the poor Jew, Nebuch, who couldn't pay his taxes to the poritz, to the local nobleman. And the local nobleman says, I'll tell you what, I'm going to kill you, Jew, but I'm going to give you one chance. All right? You see my dog? This dog, teach him to talk. Teach him to talk. If you can teach him to talk, then I'll spare your life. So the Jew says, okay, give me a year. So he says, a year? Okay, you got a year to teach a dog to talk. The Jew comes home and tells his wife, Yenta, you know, Baruch Hashem, my life is spared. You know, I got a year. That he gave me a year. All I got to do is teach this dog to talk. So she says to him, Bettel, how can you teach a dog to talk? So he says, wait a second. In a year, I can die. The poritz can die. The dog will die. Meanwhile, I got a year. All right. The same kind of thing. We work with them, you know. All right. Until the second coming, they'll be our allies. When the second coming happens, then we'll worry about it. It's a very interesting attitude. There's something to be said for it. And it's the practical Jew, once again. You got to sometimes be practical. And right now, they're helpful to us. We have to work with them, but still you have to be suspect of their agenda.
I have a question about materialism. You mentioned that it, you know, gets in the way of spirituality. On the other hand, you could say that it's helped a lot of people stay observant in terms of you can afford kosher food, have two ovens, etc., in your house, pay for Jewish education. Can you talk a little bit about sort of that tension there between materialism and the problems and benefits?
You know, I'm part of me is Hasidic enough to believe that the philosophy of Judaism is not against materialism. It's pro-materialism, but it's using materialism for spiritual ends. So the Jews have nothing against eating and drinking and being merry as long as one uses it for positive ends. I think there's a big truth to that. But then again, there is a materialism that drags us down. And I'll tell you, one of the critiques that I've heard as I go around my travels, the OU endorsed, how many products do you think the OU has its symbol on? How many? My guess? 5,000? 100,000? 6,000? Almost 250,000 products. So, and that's just the OU, and there are numerous other conscious organizations. So that's a lot of products. my grandchildren, my little grandchildren, say, Xavier, why would you want to leave your nice shul in Baltimore and go up to New York and stamp all those ketchup bottles? I can't understand. Why do you want to do that for? You're leaving us. You imagine a six-year-old with grandson saying that to you. You're leaving me for stamping ketchup. I don't understand it. So, I haven't stooped to that level yet. But someone pointed out to us to me once, you know, you talk about spirituality and everything else, you know, the Jewish people need 250,000 in products. I mean, we need to have 16 flavors of ketchup and 40,000 flavors of this and this and that and the other thing. One person, with reference to my talk this afternoon, which I give many times, about the need to Israel, to consider living in Israel, etc. So he said, one of the things that mitigate most strongly against Jews living to Israel is the OU. Why? Because you can go anywhere in the world and eat kosher. You have no trouble. Imagine if we had trouble eating kosher. So more people would move to Israel where they can get kosher. But you can go to anywhere in the world, really, and eat. You know, I'm sure you've been on vacation, and who knows where. Well, I've been Caribbean, here, there. And there's always some OU product that gets you through. So there is a certain materialism to that, and it does make you wonder. But the ultimate answer is that Judaism does not look down upon material pleasure. That's a different religion. We don't believe in asceticism or self-abnegation or long fasting, et cetera, et cetera. We believe that one sanctifies the material world. But one has to sanctify it. And some of the things we spoke about today, the super luxurious weddings that are just really made to show off one's wealth or to show off what really isn't one's wealth, what's one's debt. This is a misuse of materialism, and it leads to the most dire consequences. All right.
Rabbi, firstly, one of the speakers this afternoon made a very interesting observation as it relates to Baal Tshuvas. He told the story of a Rosh Yeshiva meeting with one of his Talmuds, and Rosh Yeshiva said to his Talmud, "Are you Baal Tshuva?" And the Talmud said, "No, I'm not." And the Rosh Yeshiva said, "Why not?"
Yeah.
Which I think was a wonderful suggestion for us all to keep in mind.
I got a story about that too, but go ahead.
I want to come back. You actually just alluded to the question that I want to come to on two parts. One is the fact that OU products are available so much everywhere that it's keeping us from going to Israel. You didn't really deal a lot tonight with the subject of anti-Semitism. And on that subject, one of the questions is, are we missing the signs? You said it hasn't been as bad since the 30s. On that subject, maybe you can comment on the perspective of OU and the buds throughout North America as it relates to what they're suggesting the rabbis say from the Bima vis-a-vis Aliyah, vis-a-vis what's going on in anti-Semitic activities throughout North America, and whether we are, in fact, missing the signs and what we should be looking for.
Okay. You know, vis-a-vis the Baal Tshuva remark, to start, there's a story, and this is not just a Maisa, a Baba Maisa. The Ger Rebbe, old Ger Rebbe of Beis Yisrael, was a very, very shrewd man, once said about the Baal Tshuva movement, he said, in the middle 1800s, God decided he was going to introduce into the world great wisdom. Hopefully the Jewish people would use it. Instead, science used it. Science used that great wisdom to take us to a whole new level of life. Then, in 1917, God decided he's going to start to give us back the land of Israel, and the Balfour Declaration came up, and we began to return to Israel. So who took charge of Israel? Secular Jews. Then God decided, okay, the Six-Day War, etc., I'm going to bring into the world a spirit of tshuva. So who took it? Non-observant people. They became Balei Tshuva. And the observant people didn't take tshuva far enough. Imagine if people who were born from, so to speak, would take the same enthusiasm and spirit and self-sacrifice as the Balei Tshuva do, where they would be. You know, the fact is that most people from birth, if we're honest with ourselves, will say we would never have the courage to do what a Baal Tshuva does. To change one's life, to alienate one's family, to do something completely different, et cetera, et cetera. We wouldn't do it. But if we would be ready to take our observance that we were born with to this new level of tshuva, you know, who knows where we would be. But as far as anti-Semitism, which is a less happy thing to talk about, the quote about it being worse in the 1930s was not my opinion. It was the quote that Abe Foxman, who's the head of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, who's a world-class expert in anti-Semitism, feels this very strongly, you know, based on what's out there in terms of the media, etc. And it started around the Israel-Arab conflict, but it's gone way beyond that. As far as what various organizations are doing about it, I want to tell you this, that we asked ourselves the questions that we have internally within our organization. I have like a think tank. And myself and some of the key department heads and some of the key lay leaders, we meet periodically. So we began to think, what can you do about anti-Semitism? Not a new question. But one of the answers was, very practically, we can do something about synagogue security. All right? We live in dangerous times. All of our synagogues are vulnerable to every Meshuggah terrorist who wants to throw a bomb at us or whatever. What can we do about synagogue security? So we hired a synagogue security expert from Great Britain to come over to the United States. And we offered a security workshop in-house in our offices. Also, we put it on a website that people could sign up for in various synagogues across the country. So we had 175 synagogues come to our building, and I don't know how many dozens beyond that were in the website watching the security workshop. That's one kind of thing that can be done. It doesn't take away anti-Semitism, but at least it helps protect Jewish lives. The other thing that we've seen is this email that goes around periodically. I understand it was started by, of all people, our old enemies, the Ku Klux Klan, accusing the OU and other kashrus organizations of this big poison the wells, all right? That all these products with these little symbols on them are all part of a Jewish scheme to poison the world. You see this making its rounds around the internet from time to time. Came up about 3 or 4 months ago, and we had this whole debate: should we respond? Should we not respond? Should we ignore it? We chose to ignore it. It's quieted down, but I'm sure it'll flare up again. But we've been trying to think of ways to solve anti-Semitism for a long time, and I don't think anyone's found the answer yet. If you have any answers, you know, send them into www.ou.org. We'll work on it.
We're going to take a 46-second.
Okay.
Okay, we're on. Okay, two more questions. So Reverend Weinberg wants to say something.
Yeah, the gentleman that just asked the question also raised the topic of Aliyah. I mean, I was elected to my position on a seven-point platform, and one point in the platform was to put Aliyah back on the American Jewish agenda. And I've been speaking about that, and we've been advocating it in a variety of ways, including working very closely with three movements. I mentioned this earlier today. Three groups that really actively push Aliyah of North American Jews: Tehillah, Nefesh B'Nefesh, and Alona Aleh. And again, on our website, you can pick up information about these three groups. We're very, very much involved now with this Nefesh B'Nefesh group in trying to reach his goals, which are 2,500 families to make Aliyah this summer, this coming summer of 2003. So that's a big priority, and it's something I discussed a little bit earlier today.
Yeah, I wanted to address something that's come up here that I think is important to say. I think I'm the only Chozer B'Tshuva on the panel here. No, you are too? Okay, you try. It seems to me just an existential reality that when you grow up with something that you're habituated around, in other words, you grow up from, you start your life that way, you are inculcated into habits of orthodoxy from the day you are born, that ironically speaking, it is actually far more difficult to achieve a level of intense spirituality than it would be to come to it cold. The sort of popular impression of religion is that when you come to it sort of from the outside, why would you want to do it? And, you know, Rabbi Weinberg alluded to alienation from parents and so on. But the truth is, in many ways, it's much easier. It's much easier to come to something where you already, you know, Dennis Prager said in one of his books, people ask me why I became a religious Jew. He said, because I saw the rest of the world. That's his introduction to 9 questions that people ask about Judaism. There's a profound truth that's inherent in that, right? And the you know, we were mentioning yesterday on Shabbat that there's a vort that the Shem Mishmuel, the Sakachava Rebbe, tells that basically Noah is born perfect. The Midrash says that Noah was born circumcised, and then Noah, the Zohar says, is Shabbos. And the Avot are related to Shalosh Regalim, the three holidays. So the Shem Yishmuel points out that Noah is perfect in a kind of static way, whereas Avraham, the Parsha Lech Lecha tells us, is going to be perfect. Veheye Tamim. So how is it that Noah is perfect in a way and Avraham isn't? And Chazal usually point out Noah's discredit in comparison to Avraham. So the Shem Yishmuel points out, because that kind of perfection, that kind of idea, is a static perfection. It's like being born from it. So, in a way, you have all the virtues, but it's very difficult to actually move beyond in the spiritual world. Whereas, to be a Chozer B'Tshuva, so it's true that one is inculcated into a kind of secular lifestyle and may have picked up a variety of forms of modernity that inform one's choices and one's way of thinking about things. But on the other hand, from my point of view, after many years of thinking about it, I think that there's a kind of striving and struggling and need to intensely create oneself that makes the life of somebody who comes to Judaism later actually an easier acquisition. I often feel that the hardest thing to do in Jewish life is to be firm from the beginning and to be able, especially in one's adult years, to be continuously thinking about how do I make this work. And this really takes me back to the beginning of what we were talking about and what Michael alluded to before, which is that there really is a tremendous problem in mainstream Jewry that I don't actually think is going to work from the top down. You know, when you were talking about like modern Orthodox leadership, I was wondering, with all due respect, who is this? Who are we speaking about, actually? What is this magical pantheon out there of modern Orthodox rabbis that, A, as Rabbi Weinreb alluded to, are listened to in the first place, and B, actually have some kind of intellectual authority? Rabbi Lichtenstein moved to Israel, right? Rabbi Lamb is the head of an institution, but, you know, does not qualify as a kind of luminous authority over all of modern Orthodoxy. The people who really took risks intellectually, somebody like Yitz Greenberg, for instance, were crucified. So, in many ways, I'm not sure who that would be. I actually think that it's a big problem in Jewish life for people to be looking at answers on the macro level. People look to the outside. They look to their teacher, and they look to their rabbi, and you've talked about this before. They look for this kind of performance Judaism where somebody will come and will feed me. And I actually think that the micro level is the one that works, that every Jew actually has to think about, like, how am I going to make myself better and stop worrying or wondering about the salvation that's going to come outside from the great drasha that happens in shul or the great pronouncement that's going to come from Orthodox organizations. Because the truth is that the life of Baal Teshuva is precisely that. It's the ability to look internally in a kind of revision of one's life and a review of one's life and say, how do I bring more meaning to this life? And I have to stop making excuses. I have to stop making excuses for my life and saying, you know what, I went to a boring shul when I was a kid. I can't tell you how many people I've spoken to. Well, you know, I got turned off Judaism because I hated shul when I went as a kid. And the truth is, a practicing psychologist, but basically that's the ticket to death, is if you basically are unable to transcend the past, and you continuously say to yourself, well, I have people to blame. I have my parents to blame, and I have the rabbi to blame, and I have my cheder teacher to blame, and everybody's to blame. The successful Baal Teshuva, in fact, realizes that blame is a kind of crippling pathology. You've got to put it aside, and you actually have to begin to invent your life over and over and over again. And actually, I think one of the things that absolutely plagues the Frum from Birth community, and I see this in the shul I daven in, and I see it in other shuls, is actually the inability to reinvent. The inability to recreate oneself again and again and again in a spiritual mode, because one is just so used to the paradigms and models of one's childhood and one's growing up and the way we did it at home, and we've always gone to the shul and this is where they talk, unable to break free from that. It's actually almost a kind of pitiful sight. So I think that it's not just a question of becoming a chozer b'tshuva. I think that there are reasons why the sort of indoctrinated Orthodox life leads to this kind of stagnation. And the truth is that, no, we don't talk about God. We don't talk about any of those things. Those are failings. They're not failings that are going to be magically, there's no magic bullet I see from modern Orthodox leadership. And it's actually the individual Jew who has to begin to seek, has to seek widely and far. Right? I found one of the most powerful things you talked about tonight was Professor Talmon, in terms of those dichotomies, in terms of searching for, what's especially striking to me is here's a paradigm of a book that's not about religion. Right? But the truth is that spiritual ideas, spiritual notions, spiritual paradoxes, spiritual help comes from books that may not be classically about religion at all, may not be about Judaism at all. You can find interesting ideas about how to live as an enlightened human in this culture from almost anywhere if you're willing to take the chance to see all of God's world as integrated. I hate to turn this into a speech, but that's how I really feel. To see all of God's world as integrated such that one can learn something about how to be a better Jew from a book on science, and one can learn how to be a better Jew from a book on love, and one can learn how to be a better Jew from a book on cooking. But what we have now is this kind of deadly dull dance that we sort of have the usual drashot and the usual parsha sheets, and people spend time in the pews on Shabbat reading the facts from Israel about the political situation. It's death. There's no chance of growing as a Jew if that's the kind of thing that becomes the status quo norm. Frankly, these are not things that I hear rabbis talking about anywhere, in any time in my experience. It's an enormous disappointment to everyone that I know. And the only reason actually it's not a disappointment to me anymore is that I gave up on it long ago and stopped looking on the macro level for those kinds of solutions. And if you really want to know what I think, it's that that's really the task of what Jews have to think about, is that you start on the individual level, and if you happen to find like-minded people, you can begin to form organic communities which will create a sense of, well, we're sharing things. Such as, my best example really, is Karlbach Minyanim, right? Started by Rav Shlomo Karlbach, who to me is one of the most powerful forces of Judaism in the last 50 years in Judaism, where you have basically people organized here about experiential Judaism, right? About heart Judaism. And they're forming. They're cropping up everywhere in the world all the time. My only question is, why wouldn't one do it every Shabbos as opposed to sort of the once a month thing? But anyway, we'll leave that for another time.
I agree with everything you said. I just want to say that what would be an excellent topic for a conference, maybe next year, this conference, some other conferences, the comparison of the subjective experience of a Chozer Batshuva and the subjective experience of a Frum from birth. I think you'll find some of your points true of some people, but not necessarily of all people. But the greatest challenge to the Frum from birth person that I find is complacency. The greatest challenge, I mean, modern Orthodoxy is often defined as complacent Orthodoxy.
Rabbi, you find me the funding and we'll put it on.
I found the funding. I have someplace else to channel.
Elliot, thank you so much. You gave me a perfect segue, because the next sequence after Noach for Shabbat and the Avot for the Regalim is the Shvatim for Rosh Chodesh. And the idea that because of their participation in the Chet HaEgel, the Midrash says that the men among Klal Yisrael lost their connection with Rosh Chodesh, but the women maintained it. And I want to ask a question about the position of women, in particular feminism. I loved your portrait, Rabbi Weinreb, of the Altaheim. I had the good fortune to grow up in such an Altaheim, but my question is its existence consistent with feminism on a theoretical level? If on a theoretical level, then is it consistent on an existential level? I mean, can it be done? And is it something that we should be supporting?
How many hours do you want to stay here?
I'm here.
I'll tell you, it's a very important set of questions. The handle that you gave me of the Altaheim, etc., I can't think of any more successful female feminists than my maternal grandmother and maternal great-grandmother. The great-grandmother that I mentioned before, and the grandmother who taught me not to lift my hand as Cossacks do. They were both, especially my great-grandmother, very, very, very traditional. My great-grandmother really never left the shtetl, although she was brought to America. She dressed with a kerchief. She wouldn't even wear a shetl, only a kerchief over her head. But she never went to school of any kind, but she literally knew Tanakh and the Malbim's commentary by heart, from studying it every day. She was just a very, very special woman who clearly was proud of her femininity, identified with it Jewishly, existentially, in every other way, as did her daughter, my grandmother, who was the first woman to get a driver's license in, I'm not sure if it was New York State or if it was in Kings County, Brooklyn. But she had a clipping on the newspaper that I remember from childhood that Gussie Hartman was the first woman to get a driver's license somewhere in the New York area. But she was a woman who was exceptionally devout in her own way, a little different from her mother, obviously. The mother-daughter rivalry there. So these, to me, whenever I read, think, and experience feminism, I think of especially these two women. Interestingly, my mother, as she be well, would probably be, like now she's not well, but when she was better, she would be the most articulate anti-feminist woman that I've ever met. You know, she, why do these women need all this stuff for? What do they need it? You know, women should be quiet, women should cook. You know, she was always against all my sisters and daughters, all of whom are professional. She said, no, your place is in the home, et cetera, et cetera. So she had her own way of being feminist. There is such a thing, and I'm not a big mystic. I know there were some people in the faculty today who, Susan Schneider was truly an accomplished expert on Jewish mysticism. I have enough trouble with the real world. I can't go into the world of mystery. It's not my thing. But there is such a thing as a feminine koach. There is such a thing as a feminine aspect to God. There is such a thing as a feminine aspect to men. There is such a thing as a femininity that's necessary to a full religious experience. And this is true in strict halachic Judaism. Normally it's not spoken of except in mystical terms. But there's no question that it's there. And when it's not there, it's clearly missing. There's also no question but that women... the women's voice is something that has to be heard in contemporary Judaism and can be heard even in strict Orthodox terms. You can go very far to the right and still find the teachings of Nechama Leibovitz considered extremely significant. She really revolutionized the way many very, very traditional people study Torah. And only a woman really could have done it her way. And there are other, I mean, historically, of course, you go back to biblical figures, but you can even go to temporary figures. The best, newest, you know, talking about newness and doing things in a new way, thinking out of the box, in Judaism today, on the Parsha, all right, what could be more? The Parsha, the Parsha, the Parsha, every week it's the same Parsha, every year it's the same series of Parshas. There's a woman, I forget her first name, I think it's Shulamit Elitzur, who wrote a book on the Parshiot. It's published by Mossad HaRav Kook, which is a fairly mainstream publishing house. And it's on the Parshiot, where she approaches each Parsha from a poetical dimension, from a poetical perspective. She begins each Parsha. Her expertise is early medieval piyutim. All right? So she goes back to the early Yanai, all right, that's like 6th or 7th century. She begins each parsha with a poem from one of the early medieval Paitanim, and then she expands upon the Shira component of each parsha. I think it's called Shira Shel Parsha, or Shion Shira Shel Parsha, I forget the title. But it's something extremely feminine, extremely new, but yet 100% glatt kosher, right? And it's extremely important sefer. I can't overestimate that. And there are many, many such works that are on the horizon. To make a song out of Bereishis Noach, that's easy. But she does it for Tazria, all right? that takes some doing, all right? But Sora, all right? To make a poem out of that, Dachman Kenan, and only a woman can do that. Seriously. Only a woman can take in that material and give out a poem. I don't think men can do it unless they use their feminine aspect. So I hope I'm addressing some of your questions, obviously not all of them.
On the women's prayer groups. I'm just going to make half a comment, if I may, and then we'll give our last question to, I was going to say our president, but I can't say that anymore. Our past president at the shul, so we're going to thank him and thank Beth Jacob. But first, I just want to, if you can expand just for a couple of minutes, perhaps, if Shane had this in mind, the issue of the women prayer groups. And is that, I presume you had a little of that in mind, but.
Certainly women's learning is I think, a very important aspect of the incursion of feminism into Judaism. And I think certainly women's heightened participation in ritual as well. But I think also what I was really turning to was the question of, you know, the sort of halachically pariv area of the home, where it's not so clearly circumscribed who's responsible for what, but we find very gender stereotyped behavior. In particular, Rabbi Weinreb referred to the idea of, you know, when the children come home, you know, mom is nishto. Well, why isn't tata?
That's a fair question. I can be guilty, as guilty of thinking stereotypically as anyone else. But in the role of the home, it's very interesting. If you want to see feminism in action, the place to go is Lakewood, New Jersey. Right? Because close your eyes and imagine a typical neighborhood and what the scene is at 10 after 8 in the morning. Typical neighborhood, not Lakewood, New Jersey, okay? Bismarck, North Dakota, wherever. What you're going to see is mommy at the door waving goodbye to that Tati as Tati drives off to work, right? And the children either in carpool or on the yellow school bus or wherever. In Lakewood, in the Yeshivisha community, mommy drives off to work at 10 minutes after 8. Tati stands by the door and says goodbye. So that's, I don't know if it's good or bad, but it's certainly feministic. And it's in the place where you might least expect it. But there's a certain, obviously there's a certain necessity to shake up some of those, as you say, some of those gender roles that are halachically neutral. No reason why a man can't learn. Don't tell my wife this, but there's no reason why a man can't learn to cook his own Shabbos dinner and his own cholent and his own kugel. My son does. My wife raised my son to do that, but she failed with me. Absolutely failed. But I told you, my mother was the anti-feminist, so she raised me to expect my dinner served on time. But these are, like, you're right, these are halakhically neutral. There's no reason why there can't be an appropriate shifting there, too. And you'll find more and more in traditional homes a shifting of roles for various reasons. But I was more intrigued by the feminine koach in religion and spirituality in a totally legitimate, halakhically impeccable form. And I think it's something that we're going to see more of in some surprising ways. That would be my prediction.
I just was struck with all the comments that have come. I hope I can remember all the few little things that I want to say. First of all, when Rabbi Skobach spoke before about all the talking in shul, about the Kiddush clubs and the things that the leadership from the center of leadership should deal with, it really struck home, you know, in the shul that these have been issues. And interestingly enough, the issues that the rabbi used to try to talk about and that he felt were, on the one hand, what was maybe holding back the increase in membership. On the other hand, it became clear that if you continue talking about the issues, they'd be the issues that would get him fired as well. It's very difficult, and I don't know that.
My boss.
Yeah, well, I was. I don't know that.
It's true.
That having them come from centrally would help that much. Maybe the answer, I think, as somebody pointed out, is maybe finding a few like-minded people and helping it come from within. It's not an easy thing to deal with, but if more of the people who are maybe guilty or whatever would come to sit and hear some of these sessions, maybe they'd be struck as I have. On the issue of Balei Tshuva and being frum from birth, I must say that in my own experience, at least lately, I've been, and it has nothing to do, I don't think, with me, I hope, or I don't think, but in my own family, and I think some of the friends of my kids, at least I must say that my daughters have, and my son now, and hopefully as my younger children grow up, maybe the same, who were firm from birth, but I find them being Balei Tshuva now, in the true sense of the word, and maybe they're going to drag us with them. And I would say that Israel had a lot to go into Israel after finishing high school had a lot to do with it. That's where they all began to change and are trying to maybe make our world grow as well. And then the other comment I wanted to make, as the rabbi alluded to, as many of you saw when you came in this morning a long, long time ago, that there was an election here. So I used to be the president in the shul. It's still on the English date. I was still the president today. So I don't think we gave, as a shul, we didn't give really enough support to this wonderful program. But I must, comment on behalf of the shul and all the people who are here, that really to give hakarat hatov to the people who organized this, to Rabbi Kelman, to Professor Melamed, and I'm not sure whoever else was on the committee. And Ilana, yes, mostly to Ilana. The program really, really was tremendous. There were a lot of people here. It was very successful. And anyone who wasn't here, they don't know what they were missing. And on behalf of our shul, certainly we want to thank you, and on behalf of everyone who came.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you very much. Really, thank you. There are refreshments. We'll daven Maariv in 7.5 minutes upstairs. Okay, trying to keep the schedule, you know.